All right, joining us is Joe Sheehan. As I've said so many times in the past, he's got the best newsletter on the internet at all. It comes out 3-4 times a week. We're happy to have Joe with us. Joe, how are you?
Good. Hey, Marty, I saw you tweet out the show guests. Have you already had Lincoln on?
Yeah, Lincoln was on at about 4:15. Yeah, in fact, he preceded you.
I just want to mention, I've got about 40 pages left in Baseball Goes West. Just a fantastic book. I think I knew a lot about the Dodgers story. I think that gets talked about more. But there was so much about the Giants history in there and the move and everything that followed. I really want to recommend it. Lincoln, somebody, I've read a couple of his books and I've loved them. So if people want to pick that up, they really should.
No, very good. Let me ask you this about the Giants part. What did you learn that you didn't know?
All of the reasons why the Candlestick basically was out at Candlestick,
right.
A lot of the development of the city and how that affected the location, first of both Candlestick and then later Oracle Park. Honestly, I didn't realize that the Giants were kind of at the forefront of Latino players. You know about the Dodgers and all of the African-American stars they had coming out of the Negro Leagues. I actually didn't realize that both the Giants had such a large clutch of Latin players. I guess I never really thought about it. And also the problems that Alvin Dark had managing them during that time. So there was just a lot of Giants history in there that I just hadn't known.
No, really good. Very good. Horace Stoneham, of course, brought in Philippe Alou, who was the first actual player from the island, so to speak. Ozzie Virgil came up first, but Ozzie Virgil grew up in New York, even though he was of Dominican birth. But Felipe was the first, and the Giants then started the wave of players coming in. Very good. Thank you, Joe.
Good stuff, yeah.
Yeah, for mentioning that. Well, glad to have you with us. Let everyone know where they can subscribe to what you're going to talk about, because I think that's the first thing I always want to let people know.
Yeah, joesheehan.com. You can get information on the Joe Sheehan Baseball Newsletter. It's in its 10th year now. I write about baseball. So I definitely have a stat-head perspective, but I write about the business of the game, write about games that I see. I just, I was with Prospectus for a long time. I've written for Sports Illustrated. I've written for ESPN. I've written just about everywhere. I write for Baseball America. And it's definitely, I would say it's somewhere between, I don't do a lot of reporting. It's stat-based. But it's not so far right on the stat head spectrum that you can't get into it. I'm a writer, Marty. I'm not a sabermetrician. I'm not a real math guy. I'm just a writer.
No, I love it. I love it. I get it, and you send it, and I look forward to it. And it takes us to a lot of discussions. Number one, their two-way player pitched today. Brandon McKay for Tampa Bay. He won the game over the Rangers, and I think it's amazing. He took a perfect game into the sixth inning. A little bit of a two-way player in baseball. I know the Reds drafted one a couple of years ago, Hunter Green. But how about that for Brandon McKay today?
Just looks fantastic. An unusual pitcher to watch, too, is a left-hander who steps up on the far right of the pitching rubber, but that enables him to get the ball inside on right-handed hitters. The pitching is ahead of the hitting for him in terms of his prospect status. This is what he can do. I'm not saying he's going to take a perfect game to the sixth every day, but he can give the Rays 10, 15 good starts here down the stretch. Almost the way David Price did for them 11 years ago when they made the World Series run. And he's that far developed as a pitcher. The bat, not as developed. Can you use him off the bench as a pinch hitter? Yeah, I think this is the difference between him and Shohei Ohtani, where when Shohei Ohtani came up for the Angels last year, he was a hitter who had to be in the lineup. You wanted to get him in the lineup, and it was frustrating because the Angels didn't want him hitting the day before he pitched or the day after he pitched. I think with McKay, he'll have more value as a bench bat on the days he's not pitching. There's not going to be that need to get him into the lineup, whereas the Rays can instead use him for hit for their catchers, hit for Willy Adames at shortstop. So from a roster standpoint, it might be easier to use him as a two-way player than it's been for the Angels with Ohtani.
He's exciting. I mean, the fact that you can have another guy here in the bigs that may swing the bat and pitch is exciting. And they're projecting him to be like a number two starter. So he's very good on the mound. This is a good segue, then, to stick with the Rays to talk about the comments from Tommy Pham this week about the All-Star voting, which Marty and I haven't talked much about. But seems like, and to follow up Pham's comments about how these smaller market teams are getting hosed, guys like Matt Chapman and Semien with the A's weren't even in the conversation. Can we talk a little bit about the voting this year?
Yeah, I've always been a fan of the fan voting. I think the fans have, by and large, got it right over the years. And that goes back to 1970 when they gave the vote back to the fans. When you have that many people voting, a lot of the biases simply wash out. If you look at the fan voting for starters throughout the years, not only do you generally get the stars into the game, you get a pretty good cross-section of players from around the country as well. You go back through this decade starters. You know, the Royals had three starters 1 year. The Braves had three starters last year. The Cubs have had three starters in some years. And you look even this year. There's an Indian. There's a Twin. There's a Diamondback. There are biases built in that wash out when you have this many people voting. So I think the fan voting is just fine. You know, fans' objection, the idea that you're going to turn this into, well, let's use, you know, WOBA and WRC. I'm like, you know, if I had proposed this, guys, you know, Stathead, a non-player, I would have been laughed out of the room. I wrote the other day, I think Tony Kornheiser literally would have plucked. you don't. The whole argument is, well, you can't use stats to judge everything, and that's fine. I think the fan voting is not the problem. If you look at the history of the player voting, guys, you can look at the results, and you can see that the players are, by and large, voting for the guys who have the big baseball card numbers in the first half, batting average, home runs, RBIs, wins, saves. The players haven't really ever surprised us. The players aren't adding a whole lot to the process. They want to be involved. They've been very clear on that. But when you look at the player voting, it's voting for the guys who have a lot of RBIs in the first half. I think I'd have more respect for the player voting if they ever put somebody in who was hitting 225, but the players know that he's really that good. And the players have literally, in whatever it is now, 11 years of them back doing the voting, literally never made a selection that couldn't be explained by baseball card stats in the first half.
All right. So it works well. It does work well. It started in 1933 during the Depression. That's how the All-Star Game came about, to raise money. Arch Ward of the Chicago Tribune came. Oh, was it 34 or 33? I forget what year.
It was 33 out in Wrigley Field, I believe, they held the first one. And fans voted on and off, and they voted every year since 70. Yeah. If anything, I think we've gotten too far away from that. I had a friend point me to the 57 All-Star Game, the box score the other day. And the NL outfield was, you know, Hank Aaron, Willie Mays, and Frank Robinson. And for the most part, until about the 1970s, the best players in the game stayed in the game the whole way. So the ninth inning, you still had the best players in the game. The All-Star Game now has a church picnic feel to it, where they're just trying to get everybody in the game, and I think that's contributed. There's been a contributing factor, there are a lot, to the loss of prestige of the All-Star Game.
Boy, interesting. All right, Joe, let's jump to this. The Giants, of course, are in the news with Bumgarner, Will Smith, maybe some of the other bullpen pieces. This is a team. They get a lead in the sixth inning, they could bring it home, and I've seen it repeatedly this year. That's why they're 35-46 as opposed to a worse record. But teams that are surprising maybe right now, who will stay in or not stay in over the next month, give us your perspective on that.
You know, I've been pretty skeptical about teams like the Padres, the Rangers, particularly I've written about them. I look at the way the Reds are playing right now. They got beat up today by Javier Baez, but their underlying numbers, even though they're under 500, are very good. You could see them make a push here. You look at the Angels, who are healthy basically for the first time all year. Otani's back, Upton's back. They've gotten rid of Matt Harvey and Trevor Cahill. They've got Griffin Canning in the rotation now. Andrew Heaney's healthy. Tyler Skaggs is healthy. I think they could be one of the teams that pushes the Red Sox for that second wild card spot. On talent, it should be the Yankees, Red Sox, and Rays all making the playoffs. But the Red Sox have really struggled to get it together. We saw them give up, 395 yards of offense today to the Yankees. And I don't know that they're going to be able to get their pitching together. So they've really opened the door for these three teams in the NL West, the AL West, the A's, the Angels, and the Rangers. And, you know, the Indians, who I don't know what's going on in Baltimore this weekend, but, you know, the Indians are trying really hard to convince us they're not a contender.
What do you think about teams that are up at the top? The Yankees being maybe buyers for a top-line starter. I know now you've lost Giancarlo Stanton for about a month or so. Maybe Clint Frazier's coming back. Are they going to be buyers in a market where they may not need a top-line pitcher to win a World Series?
So they're going to need position players. They'll go out and find Brad Wilkerson or something, and they'll hit 320 for 3 weeks. It's the Yankees. I think the question is, are there frontline starters out there? And I know I'm going to get in trouble saying this on San Francisco radio, but Madison Bumgarner is not that guy anymore. You know, he's somebody who I think projects as a low number two, a high number three, especially if you get him out of the Oracle Park and get him into a better hitter's park. So I think there's really some concerns about what Bumgarner is going to be in a different environment. The Nationals have played well enough that I don't think you'll see Strasburg or Scherzer shopped. They did try to trade Bryce Harper last year, so I could be wrong about that. But I would be surprised to see the Nationals as sellers. You look at a Marcus Stroman, he's also, you know, number three. There's just not a lot of number ones out there. What the Yankees did last year is they went out and got J.A. Happ. And all they want to do is say, hey, look, we're going to get our starters to the fourth or fifth inning and count on this ridiculously deep bullpen to take it home. I think you'll see them go with the same play this year, maybe add some innings, but then know that they can get 12 outs a night from that bullpen.
All right, we'll see where we go. Tampa Bay and Montreal, they're talking about splitting the season. What do you think about that?
If you think of Sports Illustrated this week, I've got a page on this whole thing. And really all it is trying to extort a park from somewhere, whether it's Montreal, whether it's the Tampa area, whether it's kind of throwing signals out to places like San Antonio and Portland that baseball is willing to deal. This idea that you would have a team play 40 games in two different countries, much less different cities, is utterly ridiculous. For one thing, the players would never go along with it. Okay, you're going to spend 3 months in Florida, then you can uproot your family to a foreign country. It's a full employment program for tax attorneys. So this is never going to happen. All it is, it's like contraction back in 2001. The butt seal was saying, we're going to get rid of two teams. It was just a threat. That's all it was. And this is just threat to the Tampa market to say, if you don't build the ballpark, we are going to actively start looking elsewhere. And let's face it, guys. You know, it's not – everybody talks about how bad that ballpark is, the Tropicana Dome. And it's not a bad ballpark. It's certainly – it's an Astrodome in a Camden Yards world is the way I put it. But it's the location more than anything else. It's very hard for the people in Tampa to get to St. Petersburg unless you have a helicopter. If they took the Suncoast Dome, the Trop Dome, and put it in Tampa, they'd actually be in pretty good shape. So the issue isn't the ballpark, it's the location.
Yeah, Joe, I mean, I've been to that ballpark. The best explanation or description I've heard of Tropicana Field is it feels like you're playing baseball in a giant Costco. And that's, I think, pretty accurate.
But even then, I think if you had that ballpark in where the people are, you wouldn't have a team that's drawing, you know, that's basically been last in the AL in attendance four straight years, that hasn't drawn 2 million since the inaugural season. It's just the difficulty of getting from Tampa to St. Petersburg at 7 o'clock on a Tuesday night.
No, I agree. Hey, one thing I wanted to ask you, how about all the runs in Colorado? They're averaging 22.5 runs a game here.
Somebody went off with the humidor. Wasn't the humidor supposed to solve all
these
problems?
My God.
I think it's a team that has good but not great pitching. You know, that Padres staff, they had that 92-run series. Another team with good but not great pitching. It's the baseballs. There was some great – you're going to have Meredith Wills on later, I believe. And she's done some great research into the baseballs and why they're flying as much as they are. Anything having to do with the drag on the baseball is going to be exacerbated by the thin air of Colorado. So it's just kind of an extreme version of what we've seen throughout the game. And I don't think it's a fluke, guys. I think until the baseballs are somehow changed again, whether intentionally or unintentionally, Colorado is going to look like, you know, the baseball we were used to at the turn of the century in Colorado.
Playing on the moon.
All right, I love it. Hey, Joe, thank you so much for being on. Let everyone know one more time where they can find you.
Joe Sheehan Baseball Newsletter, joesheehan.com. Get all the information there. You can read a lot of stuff that I've written on the site. Pick up this week's Sports Illustrated for a piece on the Rays and that whole Rays Expos thing. And then the Baseball America. I'm in there every month.
I love it. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks, fellas. Take care.
All right. That is Joe Sheehan.
Good stuff.
Isn't it? Boy, he's got so much to say.
Yeah, in a short period of time. He talks quick, too. You've got to try to catch
very
his nuggets.
Good.
He's cracking jokes. He doesn't give you time to laugh. You heard him, right? He's sliding stuff in.
Yeah,
you don't get a second to laugh at it.
It was funny.